Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call and talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's our Pets and Vets program. And, it's always nice to have Dr. Ron Scharf here. He is from the Animal Hospital of Niskayuna, New York. He knows his stuff. If you have a kitty or a doggy question, it's 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Try to get in line early. The phone lines for this program tend to fill up rather quickly. You can tweet us at WAMC Vox Pop. That's one word, WAMCVOXPOP. And check in on our Facebook page as well, facebook.com/WAMC Radio. Dr. Scharf, a 1985 graduate of the Veterinary College at Cornell. Ron Scharf, welcome back to the show. How are you, sir?
Thanks so much, Ray. I'm great, and it's a great thing to be here. It's a beautiful day outside.
Indeed.
And I always get such a great welcome from you. I appreciate
it. Well, we aims to please. Now, you showed me an interesting piece of paper while Patrick was doing his newscast. I'm a little surprised. Could you give us the précis, if you will?
Okay, so whatever that means, there is an interesting dichotomy here about cats versus dogs in this country. That there are more households that have dogs, but there are more cats in the country.
Interesting.
So that is interpreted. So this is from the American Animal Hospital Association, which my hospital is a member of, an accredited member. I think it's a great organization, but they're lifting it from the AVMA, the American Veterinary Medical Association, which does a study every 5 years. It's like a census, okay? As a matter of fact, it's such good information that they gather that the U.S. Census cites information that this U.S. Pet Ownership and Demographic Sourcebook has in their demographic analysis every 5 years. So what that said, this is the 2012 sourcebook, hasn't come out yet. So this is hot off the presses. And it says that there are 36.5% of all households in the United States own a dog. But cat-owning households are 30.4. So it's about 6% less, fewer households have cats than dogs. But cats are the most common pet. And the total U.S. population of cats is about 74 million compared to 70 million dogs. So what it means is that although fewer households have cats, those cat-owning households have more cats. And the breakdown was 2.1 cats per household compared to dog owners, which average 1.6 dogs. So there's a half an animal more in the cat-owning households.
You know, the part I saw, and maybe I looked at the wrong part, was that people spend more on care for dogs than cats, even though there are more cats.
They do, and that is a whole nother issue. And I think that we might have mentioned that a few months back on a show that we had, that there is a concern that cats in this country are not getting as much medical care as they could be getting for various reasons. There are several things going into it. There was a study done a couple of years ago that addressed this issue. It is a big concern of veterinarians.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is cultural, but some of it is that cats just get very, very stressed out getting put into a box, into the car, taken to the vet. And a lot of cat-owning people just feel so bad for that, them to have to go through that. But there are various things that could be done that would make it less stressful for the cats. You can never say that it's not going to be stressful at all. All of us going to the doctor, whether it's ourselves or our kids, especially our kids, we're worried, we're concerned. What if the doc finds something?
Yeah.
What if it's going to be bad? What if there's going to be a needle? What if it's going to hurt? So it's natural that someone that can't understand English especially is going to have that much more concern.
Yep.
Cats like things their way.
Yes.
So that's a way of not having things their way, and that adds to it. But it's very good that your astute eye picked that up, Ray, because that is a big concern, that the cats are not getting in enough for their own quality of life.
And see, I thought the numbers were skewed. I thought cats, they're very smart. They probably had some money socked away on their own, and they pay for their own vet visits.
No, they're smart, and that way they hide when time comes to come in. So there are a lot of appointments that don't get kept because owner couldn't find the cat. So that's common.
It seems to me that there could be a marketing opening here. You know, I'm a kitty vet, and I make house calls.
There are people that only do feline medicine. That is, then there's a colleague of mine in this area that only does, they do just cats. That's the name of the practice.
But no house calls. See, that's
there
where the big bucks can be.
Vets. There are house call vets. As a matter of fact, one of them, Dr. Jim Robinson, does his surgeries a lot of times at my hospital, and I just saw him this morning.
Huh.
So there are house call vets, too.
Interesting. Let's go to the phones, and we go to Becky in Boston Spa. Becky, you are first today.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was calling because I go between two houses. In one house, I have a cat. In the other house, there is a dog and a cat. And I seem to be infested with fleas. And I don't know whether, A, could I have brought them, transported them with my clothes and bags from one house to the other? Because the dog and the cat in the one house are inside pets. And in the other one, they're outside. And both houses seem to have had fleas. I've tried to get rid of them this last weekend, and we'll see if that's successful or not. And so, interested in whether it's a bad year for them, and could I transport them, and what are some of the best ways to get rid of them if I find that they have recurred?
Great questions, Becky. So in my experience, I do not think that it's particularly been a bad year for fleas. I remember right before the beginning of the season, the parasite season for ticks, everyone was worried. It's going to be a bad tick year. It's going to be a bad tick year because last winter was so mild and people were thinking they were going to be horrendous. I didn't find that to be the case either. I didn't think the ticks were any worse than any other year that I've seen. But flea-wise, Becky, one of the biggest things that I picked up on from what you said is that you took care of the problem. But what a common misconception is that you can take care of a flea problem in one fell swoop. You can't. And the main reason that you can't, Becky, is because there are eggs and larvae in your house. Now, those eggs and larvae, they're in those places that the animals hang out in most. So whether that's the couch, the rug, the bed, and those eggs and larvae are not going to be treated by whatever you did the other day. Unless you're going to be using a bomb in the house, which I do not advocate, they're toxic, and I don't think that they're necessary. In the long run, I do recommend certain monthly products that if you use them long enough, depending upon the time of year, I could explain what that means, you'll have the problem under control. Now, when I say long enough, I mean that the eggs and larvae mature into adults faster when it's hot and humid, kind of like what we've had the last few days. Now, when it starts getting colder, like a couple months from now, October, November, December, then they stay in those immature forms, in the pupal form specifically, much longer. They could stay in that pupal form for months until it starts getting warm and humid again. So the early in the summer or the late spring that someone starts in the flea control, the less it'll take, maybe it'll only take 3 or 4 months to get all those eggs and larvae eventually, then the 5 or 6 months that you might have to do if you're just starting to take care of the problem in September, for instance. So in any case, Becky, I would use a monthly product, and the two that I prefer the most, one of them is an oral medication that is called Comfortis. Now, it's labeled for dogs, though many vets have used it in cats. I think that there is a cat-labeled formulation as well, but it kills all adult fleas within 4 hours. It's pretty amazing. And what I've been using for my heartworm preventive, Becky, in dogs is a combination of the Comfortis and the Interceptor, and that product is called Trifexis, and that stuff is great. And fleas carry their own parasites that could affect humans as well as animals. And the more we could do to guard against parasites, the better. The other option I recommend for dogs and cats is a product called Vectra, V-E-C-T-R-A. You have to be careful to use the dog Vectra on dogs and not on cats, because the dog Vectra would be very harmful for a cat. They have their own Vectra product, but those are the best. That's the best topical that I know of, Becky. And just stay at it for several months. And how they came in, it could have been brought in by you, but it's more likely that they were brought in by one of the animals.
All right, Becky, thanks a lot. We appreciate the call. Let's get a quick call in here before our first break. Bonnie in Bethel. Bonnie, you're up.
Okay, I have a little dog. He's a Schipperke Westingham mix. And he doesn't have fleas, but he's really itchy, dry skin and stuff like that. And the doctor has given him prednisone, and it seems to help, but then when I try to wean him off it, it gets really bad again.
So, Bonnie, how long has he been itchy?
Well, off and on, you know, for a couple of years, but it's like 2 pills a day for 10 days and then 1 pill a day and then every other day. The minute I don't do 2 pills a day, he suffers a lot.
Oh, well, so it sounds to me, Bonnie, like it's most likely that your Schipperke cross has an allergy. And there are several kinds of allergies. There are allergies to things we're breathing in. That's called atopy, A-T-O-P-Y. There are allergies to things that they might be eating. And then there could be just contact allergies as well. That is the order of the popularity. It's atopy or allergic inhalant dermatitis is the most common, followed by either flea allergy dermatitis or food allergy. And the thing that I always ask first, Bonnie, is to find out if there's a seasonal variation, which I'm picking up from you because you said it was on and off, that there is a seasonal variation. And if you see spring and fall as to be times that the animal's more itchy, then chances are that that animal is breathing in something that he or she is allergic to, and allergic dogs and cats are itchy, and they goat themselves. And if you let them goat themselves enough, they can make an infection. And then you got to treat them with antibiotics as well as something to address the allergy. Now, the allergy, Bonnie, the ideal is to just get rid of whatever they're allergic to, but that's not always practical or possible. There are ways, by the way, of finding out what they're allergic to, not only by detective work, but by blood test. The blood test tells you what are they allergic to in this part of the country that they might be breathing in. They check, I don't know, 30 different potential inhalant allergens. And they also check a certain number of the most common food ingredients to see if there's a food allergy involved. Animal could have both, Bonnie, in which case you'll have both seasonal as well as year-round level. It'll be a certain elevated baseline of itchiness all through the year, which then has even higher peaks during those typical inhalant seasons. So is your pup, Bonnie, who I don't know how old your Schipperke is, how old are they? 10?
He's 7.
7. Okay. So, and it's a male or a female?
Male.
So he is itchier in certain seasons, Bonnie?
Well, the summer he seems to be pretty itchy. Sometimes it's in the winter. I haven't really noticed the pattern, to tell you the truth.
Okay. Well, your vet should, because the vet should have, if you've let them know about it,
yes,
some running tally, because it's impossible for an owner to remember this kind of stuff. It's a, put it this way, a rare owner that on their own can remember when in the year that those itchy episodes happen. So that's the great thing about a medical record. I always, whenever I get an itchy animal, look at the chart. I go back. I see if there's a seasonal variation. And I'll tell you something, Bonnie, in the last few days, since Monday, I've seen a whole heck of a lot of itchy dogs.
Bonnie, we got to take a break here. We appreciate your call very much. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. We have a question from Facebook. We'll address that in a moment. In the meantime, more of the Pets and Vet Show coming up.
Support for WAMC comes from PS21 Performance Spaces for the 21st Century, Chatham, New York. Presenting Parsons Dance, performing Round My World, A Stray's Lullaby, and other recent work on Friday, August 31st, and Saturday, September 1st at 8 p.m. PS21Chatham.org. The Yiddish Book Center, Amherst, Massachusetts. Exhibits, educational programs, performances, films, an English language bookstore, group tours, and a million Yiddish books. YiddishBookCenter.org. The Sterling and Francine Clark Art Institute in Williamstown, Massachusetts, presenting Unearthed, Recent Archaeological Discoveries from Northern China, clarkart.edu. The Digital Berkshire Eagle, an online newspaper for news and information of the Berkshires and beyond, noinkyfingers.com. And Whitney's Farm Market and Country Gardens, Cheshire, Massachusetts. You pick blueberries, Whitney's own butter and sugar corn, vine-ripened tomatoes, vegetables, Boar's Head Deli, fudge and baked goods, whitneyfarm.com.
Vox Pop, it's the Pets and Vet Show, 800-348-2551. Dr. Ron Scharf is our guest, 800-348-2551. Or you can tweet us at WAMCVOXPOP, WAMC Vox Pop, one word. You can go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/WAMC radio. Donna checks in via Facebook and asks the doctor, why does my dog take several pieces of food out of her dish in the kitchen, bring them to the living room and leave them on the floor there, and then return to the kitchen to eat her dinner regularly? What do you think?
Well, that's very interesting. I would imagine that there are certain pieces of the food that the dog thinks are worth storing for later use, possibly. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's a kind of a throwback to a more atavistic time in the species. I don't know. On the other hand, the dog could just be idiosyncratic.
All right, Donna stumps the band. Donna, you got a bonus point and a gold star. Here's one from Twitter. Teach789 asks, oh, this is unfortunate. I have two dogs. The dominant one pees on the other one when she is peeing. I let them out one at a time. How do I make it stop? How do they make it stop, the whole peeing issue?
Well, to let out one at a time, I'm not sure how it could be happening. But these behavioral things, Ray, they need more than just 20, 30 seconds to be able to answer these questions, because their behavioral things are complex. And I don't know why. I don't know when each dog was gotten, how old they are, what the genders are. Are they intact? Are they neutered or spayed?
You're really not playing along very well with this whole Twitter thing.
Okay. So the Twitter thing is that the dominant dog needs to be explained how things really ought to be.
Okay. And how would one do that?
So the way that one does that is by rewarding behavior that's good and by not rewarding behavior that's not good. And there are ways to do that. But the easiest thing is to bring the dog up in a way that I call the nothing in life is free philosophy.
Okay.
The nothing in life is free philosophy is that they get rewarded for doing all the actions and behaviors that we want to encourage. That's calmness, that's civility, that's good manners,
right.
That's not jumping up, not biting, etc., not doing their business in the house. Then they get rewards. They don't get rewards for nothing. The rewards are not only food and treats, but their attention, their playing, their high tone of voice, oh, what a good boy, what a good girl,
right.
Kind of thing.
Yeah.
That all those things are learning opportunities to teach the dog that there are behaviors that will be rewarded with good things, and if they don't do those behaviors, there won't be nearly as many good things happening in their life. They may have a meal that's delayed by 45 minutes or a half an hour,
yeah,
because they weren't acting calmly enough to get it, or they weren't sitting immediately after they heard that order given before the meal would be allowed to have, they would have access to the meal.
Mm-hmm.
So if you bring them up in the nothing in life is free mode, they learn that there's a two-way street, there are consequences to their,
yeah,
actions, and then later, when you get a behavior which is not the kind of behavior you want, you have a foundation upon which to build that they won't be getting as much good stuff when they're doing that bad stuff.
Yeah, do I have operant conditioning wrong? Or, I mean, in this case, the dog is peeing on the other dog. Isn't some negative reinforcement in line for this?
It's out of fashion, Ray, to use negative reinforcement, and I have a feeling that most trainers do not use negative reinforcement because there are too many abusive situations in the world, and a lot of dog owners interpret things emotionally. They take it personally,
yeah,
and that leads to a bad thing. So what you do is you have great playtime after business is done,
right?
And then if the dog is peeing on the other dog, they find out, oh, they're not getting the playtime afterwards, or they're not getting the treat afterwards when they do their business, or they're not getting stuff that they know they've gotten many times before, and then eventually, hopefully, they figure out, heck, I'm not getting the good stuff. Let's make that good stuff come back.
All right. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. We go to Scott in Ballston Spa. Hiya, Scott.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Thanks for waiting.
Question. I've got a Shih Tzu poodle mix. He has to have his anal glands expressed about once a month. He does scooching and the glands are full. Was wondering if there's anything that we could do for him to lessen the need, the frequency for having that done, or any alternatives down the road if he continues to have this problem.
Yes and yes, Scott. If there's anything that you could do to try to lessen the frequency of it, is something that only helps sporadically. But I've seen a few dogs get better when they're fed a higher fiber diet. So whether that's the food itself or whether it's adding Metamucil to the food or some bran, some wheat bran or whatever, that sometimes the extra bulk in the stool will stimulate, I suppose, those anal sacs to empty when they ought to empty rather than filling up. And when they ought to empty is usually when the animal bears down, which I don't want to get too graphic, especially
in front
of this cat person, Ray, here.
Yeah.
But when they defecate, you know, when they that's typically the time that they'll bear down, and they should empty those glands if they're working correctly. The extra fiber may help, but it may not. Now, every month is a lot, Scott, and if that continues and you can't do something about it, then there is a procedure, a surgical procedure, in which you could remove those glands. They don't need those glands for good health. And if that's a dog that's doing it every month forever, then that's a good candidate for having that surgery, Scott.
Okay. Are there any significant complications we need to be worried about from the surgery?
It is unlikely, if the surgery is done correctly, that there would be complications, but any surgery is subject to the possibility of complications, especially since those anal sacs are embedded within the anal sphincter muscle.
Mm.
So even if the surgical technique is perfect, but the animal is not cooperative and they go at it and they are allowed to chew at it, that could be somewhat on the bad side and could cause an infection or worse.
Yeah.
So it could be, but it's not likely if done correctly with an Elizabethan collar afterwards.
Right. Scott, thanks for that. Let's go to Tim in Albany. Tim, you're up.
Yeah, I originally had a question about fleas, but that was answered. So my next question would be, I have an American Bulldog Pit Bull mix, and he's about 10 years old, and recently I've been seeing a lot of skin tags on him.
Skin tags?
Can you explain about what that's all about?
Yes. So, Tim, there are many different things that people will call by the same name, and skin tags is one of them. And it may be what a vet would call skin tags, and it may be other things like adenomas. In any case, dogs often get bumps on their skin. Now, depending upon what they are, things could be done about them. They could be removed surgically if necessary, but the vast majority of bumps that a dog gets on their skin are not malignant. Now, if it's a benign mass, it could still be subject to some bother, such as some of them will get bumped, they'll bleed, they'll scab over, they'll get bumped again, they'll bleed, maybe they'll get infected, and eventually the owners just don't want to have to deal with it, in which case that's an adequate enough reason to remove them surgically as well. The problem is that some dogs get a lot of them. So you have to sometimes pick and choose. Yesterday, I had a dog, an 11-year-old Golden, that I took off, I think, four different bumps. One of them was big, three of them were small. And then I put a needle into three others because we didn't know if they were serious enough to need removal. They turned out to be lipomas, which are benign fatty tumors, which are not a problem if they're not growing. So it depends on what these actual skin tags are, Tim. And if they're truly skin tags, are they sticking out enough to get caught on something?
Hmm.
Tim?
No, they're like the size of a small nipple, about all they look like. And no, they don't seem to be bothering. Just I've been, you know, petting them down, looking for ticks and everything. And
okay.
I've been noticing them.
And are they smooth or are they rough?
They're smooth.
They could just be cysts. They don't even have to be growths, Tim. They could be cysts in which, you know, the dog's got glands all over the place, all over the skin. The epidermis has glands, and sometimes those glands get plugged. The duct that takes the secretion away can get plugged. That could turn into a cyst.
Yeah.
And the cyst is not necessarily a tumor, though sometimes the cysts are bad enough to need surgical removal also. I had a Golden that every year we'd get a new crop, a new bumper crop of those cysts, and they were pretty big. They were hair gland origin, and so I did have to do some surgeries on my own dogs on a somewhat regular basis on Maggie. So it depends. I don't know if Tim's still
listening. I'm sure he's listening, yeah.
But they may be nothing to worry about. I'd have them checked out by the vet.
Okay, we go to Tara in Bloomington at 800-348-2551. Hiya, Tara.
Hi, how are you?
Good, welcome.
I have a Shih Tzu. Actually, I've called several times about him, and you've been so helpful. I'm so thankful for this program and this station in general. I have a behavior question about my Shih Tzu, and I heard you say they're hard to answer, so I don't know if you can help me. But he does a circling when he goes outside and before he'll he does a duke.
Yep.
He has to circle around
that.
And circle around. And what is the reasoning behind that?
So I've often wondered that myself, Tara, because I have a dog. She doesn't circle, but she goes back and forth and back mm-hmm. and forth, and she'll do it. And in the beginning, you get a little impatient, and I would try this strategy of, all right, already, just do it.
No, it
that
doesn't
didn't
bother
work.
Me.
No, that didn't work. I don't know why, Tara. I think that there's just something that it's like some people are just ritualistic. They just, when they do something, they need to, whatever, they need to avoid the cracks in the sidewalk, or they need to do something in a certain way. That's how they get comfortable. And that's the impression, that's the first thought that I would have about your Shih Tzu, Tara, is that
so
it's just
a comfort.
It's a comfort for him. Now, it could be like two callers ago had an anal sac problem, and if that were the case, it might have an effect on how the dog looked when he or she was preparing to do her business, her duke. However, I doubt it's that, because if it were
his
the case...
His anal glands are good.
Yeah, you'd see other things. So I think it's just a ritualized behavior that he got used to, and let's just celebrate our pet's individuality.
Good enough.
Oh, I love him, and thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It's Christine in Woodstock. Hi, Christine. You're on Vox Pop with Dr. Ronald Scharf.
Oh, hello. How are you, doctor?
Thanks a lot, Christine. How you doing?
Good. So you probably have a clue about my dog's problem. He's just under 7 months old. He's a standard poodle puppy. And when his adult teeth came in at the age of 5 months, they came in brown. And at least that's how it appeared to me. But my veterinarian says it's not that his teeth are brown, it's that they have no enamel.
Wow.
Now, yeah,
that is not a dog that got any tetracycline or doxycycline early on.
No. I looked that up in the beginning when I first noticed this. I called the breeder. She said that his mother had no health issues. Well, you know, she was pregnant or nursing the puppies, and he had not been given any antibiotics, you know, since I took him from the age of 8 weeks. He thinks it could be genetic. And he's suggesting I go to a veterinary dental specialist.
Hmm.
I'd support both responses from your vet, Christine. I think that the no enamel is plausible. I think it's likely. And there are veterinary people, vets that specialize in veterinary, and there is one in this area, too, who you could ask about that if you want to get a definitive answer. But I do think it's likely. And then the next question is, if you're thinking about breeding that dog, you might want to have second thoughts about that.
Oh, no, I would never. First of all, I wasn't thinking about it. And if this were a defect, I would certainly never follow through with a plan to breed him. But
so it's all the teeth.
You know, I'd like to try to, I would like, yes, pretty pervasive. His molars, his incisors, all his teeth.
Wow.
Doesn't seem to bother him right now, but my local veterinarian in Saugerty said that this is going to be a lifelong condition and it will need treatment and possibly cause him pain in the future because his teeth may erode because there's no protective enamel. Mm,
exactly, exactly.
But you've never heard of this or
I've
not
heard
much?
Of it. I've heard of it, but I've never witnessed it in one of my patients before. It's pretty rare.
It's pretty rare. Well,
in my experience.
I got lucky. Lucky girl mm-hmm. with a lucky puppy. Yep.
Yeah. What are you going to do? Well, you could do this would be a dog that I would be diligent but careful about brushing those teeth. Try to keep them as clean as possible. And there are some antiseptics that you could either put in the mouth as a brushless gel or add to the drinking water that will discourage. They won't stop, but they'll discourage the bacteria that cause periodontal disease.
Okay.
And you might want to try to, you know, just exercise as much dental health as you can with the dog just to make the future less problematic, hopefully.
Okay.
Right. I mean, this could shorten his lifespan in theory, couldn't it?
It could. It could in one way or another. It may not. Hopefully it won't.
All right.
Right. All right.
You're very on top
of
it, Christine.
Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Christine, thanks a lot. It's Dr. Ron Scharf. It's Vox Pop. It is Pets and Vets. If you want to tweet us, you can do so. WAMC Vox Pop, WAMC VOX POP. That's all one word. Or you can check in via Facebook at our Facebook site. That's facebook.com/WAMC Radio. And, Doctor, here's one from Janet on Facebook. She asks, I recently moved, and my two Westies, age 7, are having trouble adjusting to the new house. Won't leave my side, not eating as usual. What's your take?
Well, that's not unusual. It is a challenge not knowing how old they are and what kind of move and what is the change in their life.
Well, they're age
routine.
7.
Oh, they're both age 7.
Yeah.
Good to know.
Yep.
So I would imagine that they're siblings, if they're the same age and the same breed. I would wonder, could one of them be initiating the insecure behavior and the other one is picking up on it and they're just responding in unison? There are various things. It's, once again, it's these behavioral things that do get complicated, that do require more time than can be given in a
right.
radio show, especially without the history. I like to ask a lot of questions. The history is 70% of the diagnosis.
So in other words, the new house may be very noisy or it may be next to an airport or something.
You don't know if the animal's routine changed. You don't know if they have carpeting that one of them or both of them are having a reaction to.
Yeah.
You don't know if they're getting less attention because there's too much moving still going on. So without knowing those kinds of things, it's a stab in the dark to try to guess what it could be.
So what I've learned now is certain programs work very well for Twitter and Facebook questions. The Pets and Vet Show, not quite so much. You need to follow up.
At least the behavioral.
All right, fair enough.
Especially.
Well, let's go back to the phones. This always works out well. Emily in Chestertown. Emily, you're on with Dr. Ron Scharf.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Emily.
We adopted a dog from a shelter a little over a week ago, a 2-year-old lab mix, and he's very well behaved, but he is very, very shy, very reticent to approach us. Seems to be frightened of the male members of our family. We give him lots of attention and love. We've always had dogs, and everybody's glad that we have him, but he's not really warming up. So I'm wondering if you could give us some tips.
Absolutely, Emily. First of all, good for you that you that you provided a nice home for this rescue dog. A lot of the animals that are in the shelters came out of situations which made them gun-shy about one thing or another. And it's not very surprising to find these timid dogs coming out of the shelter. And what you need to do is be very patient and provide a very solid foundation, a love and TLC, on top of which, Emily, you also need to provide some limits. That's the rub, is that it's not just love, you know, cuddle, et cetera, but there's got to be some limits, because if you are providing that dog with clear behavioral consequences, then that dog is more able to make sense out of its world that it was not able to make before. So a dog that's timid and reticent, I assume, Emily, is one that couldn't make sense out of its world, who was getting punished for a reason that it couldn't understand, maybe was getting treats for a reason that it couldn't understand. What you want to do is provide as much structure as you can on top of that solid foundation of love and TLC, so that the dog comes to realize, and a week is very little time. Even for a younger dog, a week is very little time. There have been massive changes that dog's had to deal with. You said that he was 2 years old. That's a long time. You know, that's like taking a person who's had a very, very challenging upbringing up until the point that they're 15 or 20 years old, and then how long is it going to take them to relax and feel more solid in their world and more secure? So what you need to do is make a game. The game is, let's see how smart our lab cross is, because labs tend to be very smart, and find out what makes him the most excited and the most appreciative, whether it's treats, whether it's a Kong with peanut butter in it, whether it's just attention, whether it's a certain kind of playing, like retrieving, like throwing a ball for the dog to bring back. Find out the things, be a detective, that make that dog happiest, and then you use those things as the rewards for that dog behaving and doing the things that you want them to. What are the things that you want them to? Well, it's not just the basics of not doing their business in the house, not putting people's hands in their mouths, not being destructive, but it's also things such as calmness, being calm, not jumping up, and being civilized and a good citizen of the household, so to speak. So that when you talk about them being most scared of males, then what you do is you start acclimating them to females first. And when they start getting a little more relaxed and realizing that the females aren't a threat, then you start introducing one male at a time and preferably the least challenging of those males. So the least challenging of those males is a quiet male. It may be a male that's not huge, but on the other hand, it's not necessarily a male that's too small, because the youngsters, whether they're 7 years old, 9, 10 years old, they may not necessarily have the appreciation for how to behave in front of a dog, especially one who's scared. So just a male who's not too imposing, not loud, not moving too quickly, and then you try to teach that dog, Emily, if you can, the meaning of the word settle. And the way that you do that, this is not easy, but it's possible, is whenever that dog is in a calm frame of mind, you say, "What a good puppy," and give them a treat. You use the word settle or some similar word so that hopefully they can make a connection between that word and that behavior of being settled and not being all keyed up and nervous. And then if you can get them to settle, then you very, very slowly introduce the tiniest elements that might make them less settled. So that might be a girl, you know. And then you put them into a settle, give them a treat, and if they can handle that, you use maybe a bigger female. And then if they could, and this is over the course of weeks and months, by the way, eventually build up to males and then bigger males and let them feel like they're accomplishing something, but it's got to be baby steps. And I'm trying to squeeze a whole lot, many, many hours, literally, of behavior modification into a few minutes on the radio, but I'm trying to give you a general idea that it is possible, but you have to be patient, Emily, and it'll come along. If you're providing a calm, nurturing household with the rewards for the things that they're doing that are good and no rewards for bad things, then eventually they'll start coming along.
Emily, thanks a lot. We got to take a break here. I have been remiss. We are overdue, so let's do that now. Zach, 800-348-2551. Pets and Vets, home stretch coming up.
Support for WAMC comes from the Legislative Gazette. Daily reports from newspapers from around New York State at legislativegazette.com, the weekly newspaper of New York State government. The Mount, Lenox, Massachusetts, presenting Music After Hours every Friday and Saturday evening through August, and Berkshire Word Fest, a weekend literary gathering, September 14th through 16th, edithwharton.org. Spectrum 8 Theaters, Albany, showing Hollywood, American, independent, and foreign films. Their Ultraviolet Cafe is next door for before and after the show. Open daily, spectrum8.com. The Waldorf School, Saratoga Springs, New York, celebrating 30 years educating children, enrolling pre-K through 12th grade for the 2012-2013 school year. WaldorfSaratoga.org. And RJ Stables, Hadley, Massachusetts, locally owned dining establishment since 1960, open for breakfast and lunch until 2, offering homemade breads, cookies, and pastries. Parking available, 413-586-4305.
1-800-348-2551. Dr. Ron Sharf is here. Pets and Vets. From Facebook, Pamela asks, my 2-year-old male cat is drooling copiously. My vet is stumped. Any thoughts?
2-year-old cat drooling copiously.
Yes.
Well, I would say if the vet's stumped, then the vet has already checked that there's no foreign body or broken tooth inside the mouth. The drooling copiously, I'd want to know in response to what? I would imagine that it's not at all times. My cat, who was rescued from a barn at 3 months of age, whenever he gets a lot of attention, he starts drooling also. So I'd want to know, what pattern is it? When does the drooling start? If it's not a foreign body, and I have found foreign bodies in animals' mouths, and if it's not a dental problem or a broken tooth, then I would start thinking that it is behavioral, and I would pursue it on that basis.
Okay. Let's go back to the phones at 800-348-2551. Karen in Dallas, Texas. Karen, are you really calling from Dallas, Texas?
Yes, I am. I have a good friend of mine who lives in Amherst, Massachusetts, and we talk on the phone all the time about our pets. And when she heard your program earlier this afternoon, she called me and said, "You have to call in and ask the question about Milo."
All right. Well, this is very cool. You're on, so go ahead.
And you sound like you're around the corner. Okay.
Oh, great. Okay. Well, I have two Italian greyhounds, and the one that I'm having an issue with is 1 year old. He just turned one last month. Beautiful male fixed Italian greyhound. And I started him on a regimen of allergy shots maybe about a month ago, and I wonder if perhaps this has something to do with it, although my vet thinks maybe not. A few weeks ago, I noticed as he was curled up on my lap when I was typing on the computer, all of a sudden he woke himself up because his head started nodding from side to side, almost like he was saying no. But it was a very rhythmic, very... very involuntary response, and it really frightened him, and he tried shifting his weight and hiding his head in, you know, in my armpit, and but yet I could still feel that side to side head bob. And it's happened three other times. One time I was getting my shoes on so we could go to the park, and he was sitting right in front of me, and all of a sudden his head started, you know, bobbing from side to side, and it lasted a couple of seconds. And then a few days ago, kind of in the middle of the night, he woke up with this, and that lasted quite a few minutes. So my vet doesn't think that it's a seizure per se, because it's not textbook. You know, he's aware that it's happening. He's kind of not comfortable with it happening, and he doesn't have the teeth gnashing and the other, you know, symptoms that come with seizure activity. And I was just wondering if you had any thoughts or ideas of what it could possibly be.
All right.
Okay, so a few things that I wonder about, Karen. Did you say that Milo's on allergy shots?
Yes.
What are they? Are they something from a lab that analyzed what he's allergic to?
Yes. Yeah, he had a scratch test, and we have serums, and we administer. We've just started. I think this is his fifth dose that he just received a few days ago on that regimen. So I wonder if that has anything to do with it. We administer the shot at the nape of the neck, you know, the scruff.
Right.
But the head bobbing doesn't originate there. It's more, you know, the cranial part, if that's even the right terminology, you know, at the base of the skull, not at the neck.
Right. But if Milo's had four episodes and Milo's on the fifth dose, have you seen these things happen soon after the injection is given, like that day or the following evening or whatever?
No. I mean, looking at the schedule of shots, and I've been keeping a diary of, you know, when these bizarre head bobbing episodes occur, you know, it's not within 24 hours of administering the shot. It's a few days afterwards.
Although I doubt that the shots have anything to do with it, I would stop the shots until we could find
out. Why would you doubt that they have anything to do with it?
Allergies don't usually show up as a head bob like that, like she's saying. They could show up as head shaking.
But it could be something in the shots, though?
Yes, absolutely.
Hmm.
But I don't think so. That's not high on my list. However, it's something that's easy. It's an easy variable to control.
Yeah.
It's easy to stop a shot, okay? So just for the sake of, you know, unmuddying the waters, I would stop doing any kind of exogenous medication or injections, just to be on the safe side, and then find out. Don't do any other things at the same time so that you could see whether or not you're changing one variable makes any difference.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, are you sure, or is your vet sure, that there's nothing actually in the ears themselves, Karen? There's no ear infection or anything like that?
No, I brought him in, and they, you know, the vet checked him out and
looked inside the eardrums, inside the ear canals.
Yep.
Good,
uh-huh.
Excellent. I'm glad to hear that. Now, the next thing is that this is often an allergy season in this part of the country. I don't know about Dallas, but
it's always allergy season in Dallas.
Okay. So
it's horrible down here.
I don't know that there is no underlying allergy, and I'll tell you why. My dog, who I think has allergies which show up in her ears, will sometimes get an infection and then is very lackadaisical about scratching the ear. In other words, usually animals, they'll go at themselves intensely to the point of self-traumatizing themselves. But some animals are more slow motion, just kind of very barely scratching themselves in the face of either an infection in the ear or an allergy that's localizing to the ear. In other words, an itchiness.
Yeah.
So it's possible that an allergy itself can be causing the slow motion side to side, in which case a very quick and easy way to figure out whether or not it's that theory is just to put the dog on some prednisone for a week or two. To find out, does it stop that side-to-side stuff? And if I had to say of the possibilities of, is it due to allergies or the allergy injections or neurological, I would go with the allergy personally. Mm. I would say that the allergy is causing a low-level itch, which somehow is not low-level enough to not be waking the dog up in the middle of the night. But another question I just wanted to make sure I covered with you, Karen, is does your dog have a fontanelle, you know, with a soft spot in the skull in a baby person calcifies over, but in a dog, they should not be born with a soft spot anymore. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I'm not entirely sure.
So a fontanelle, if you've ever seen a newborn baby, is a soft spot where there is no calcified skull yet, but there will be later. But dogs, and especially dome-shaped dogs like Chihuahuas, etc., sometimes can have a fontanelle that does not close over. And although the Italian Greyhounds are not as dome-shaped a dog breed as a Chihuahua or some other ones like Pekingese, I'd wonder about that because they're so fine-boned. All you do or have your vet do is take your fingertip very gently, put it on the top of the dog's skull, and gently press and see on the midline whether or not there's any depressions.
Hmm.
Because if there's a fontanelle, then the unlikely possibility exists that they're more susceptible to trauma because they don't have the protection from the skull as much. And then there could be a neurological basis to the side-to-side head shake. But my money's going on allergy, Karen.
Okay. Karen, thank you so much for calling.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Bye.
Good luck, Karen.
Let's see. Okay, Pat in Massachusetts. Pat, you got about a minute and a half to ask the question, and we have about a minute and a half to answer. Okay, you're on.
Okay, I'm calling for my son who lives in Palmer, Alaska. He just called me. He took his children who had just lost a cat a few weeks ago to get another kitty. They adopted a year-old cat, brought it home. They had a call from the rescue yesterday, and they were making the cat an indoor cat, and they knew that. And the woman called and strongly urged them not to make this cat an indoor cat, to make it an indoor-outdoor cat. They don't want to do that because of where they live. There's a lot of predators around.
Mm.
They live in a large house. The cat has got free run of the house, seems to be settling in very nicely. And they also recommended that they get another cat because this cat had a buddy. He's a year old.
Would there be
any reason that you can think why they would want them to make it an outdoor cat?
And this is, Pat, the rescue organization, which is urging to let the cat go out?
Yeah, it's not a shelter. It's a cat rescue, I think they got it from. And it was the woman at the cat rescue that called them last night.
I would have no idea what her logic is, but I would not necessarily do what she's saying in this case.
Well, that's what I do. I volunteer at the Dakin shelter down here, and when cats go out, they strongly recommend that all their cats be made indoor cats.
Yeah, I totally agree. Unless you live way out in a rural area, and especially in Alaska, where it could get pretty cold, I don't see any reason to, unless the cat is going crazy. If you have, say, an intact male cat that's been going out all its life and finally at 8 years of age or 9 years of age, it gets rescued, neutered, and it's so used to going out. That's a tougher situation to keep that cat in.
This is a year old that's been neutered, and he seems to be settling in. Did he go to the door when they first? Yes.
Leave him in. Leave him in, Pat. I totally support your take on this.
Okay, thanks so much.
Pat,
you're welcome.
You.
Good job.
I think, Doctor, it's probably the best time to wrap it here. We only have about 30 seconds. Anything you want to impart before we wrap here?
Well, let's not take behavioral calls before the break.
All right. Now, okay. You know what? This is getting to be a contentious program.
And I thought it was a great show. I mean, we got a lot of calls, and I think that the Twitter makes it challenging. The Twitter and Facebook, when I can't have back and forth, I was taught at Cornell that history is 70% of the diagnosis,
yeah.
Meaning 7 out of 10 times you don't need a physical exam, you don't need lab work, you don't need x-rays. You can get the diagnosis just by asking the right questions. It's extreme, and I like to ask questions. And if I can't ask questions, I'm chomping at the bit to ask a question. I can't. There's somewhere out in the Twitterverse out there a question that hasn't gone answered.
Okay.
So especially the behavior ones, they will be the biggest challenges with Twitter and Facebook.
The subtext here is that you're a caveman who doesn't like new technology. And that's where we'll leave it.
Not a Luddite.
thank you very much, Dr. Scharf. Support comes from Brattleboro, Vermont, featuring music, art, and other cultural activities throughout the fall season in the greater Brattleboro area, brattleborochamber.org. Mountain Flame, Arkville, New York, offering Wittes Fire by Design wood-burning pellet and gas stoves, including the shaker stove with both short and long bench, mountainflame.com. And Woodstock School of Art, featuring their exhibit Woodstock Prints Past and Present, a survey of Woodstock printmakers, curated by Ron Netsky, September 8th through November 3rd, woodstockschoolofart.org. All right, thanks to Zachary T. Malloy, who handled the controls. Our phones were answered by Colleen O'Connell. Thanks to all of you for calling in. Sorry if you didn't make it through this time. We'll do it again next month. Our producer's Patrick Donges. I'm Ray Graff. On tomorrow's show, it's Cars with Gordon Fricke. Stay tuned now for a news update.